adopted. Cheryl works for a women's self-defense nonprofit run by Klee's parents, and Klee is well-schooled in body slams and other sorts of marital moves and postures. Cheryl does her best to keep up, but escapes this particular abuse by entering various psychic parallel universes she has devised. She fantasizes about a relationship with her co-worker Philip, and she obsessively seeks a baby named Kobelko Bondi, whom she sees perpetually in other babies she encounters day by day. "Are you Kobelko Bondi?" she sometimes asks babies, or the protruding abdomens of pregnant women, and mostly, the answer is affirmative. Throughout July's work, she seems to believe in these alternative psycho-spiritual spaces and matter-of-factly presents them. They are often aided by technology, cell phone photos and the like. As Cheryl goes from being Klee's enemy to Klee's lover to Klee's new mother, it would not be told as a great American love story for our time, the book gets a little bogged down. Either despite or because of the violent roughhousing, Klee never comes into sharp focus. Though late in the novel, we are told she looks like Scarlett Johansson, which gives one pause. Still, there are amusing moments. The Gregorian chant CD was not our song, but it was very similar to the one we'd heard on the radio that first morning. The First Bad Man is not the sexual horror story it initially seems, though many characters are in sadistic relationships, nor is it the coming-out story it seems briefly to be, but it does become a different kind of coming-out story. Once Klee becomes mysteriously pregnant, the likely birth father, revealed at the end, finds the baby, Jack, standoffish, and so believes he is not the actual father. The novel clicks into gear. Compare the glancing treatment of the newborn in, say, The Portrait of a Lady, to the concentration on the newborn here. Jack took one look at him and had a massive bowel movement that exploded his diaper. Yellow cottage cheese was everywhere. And the reader can see which is the novelist on whom nothing will be lost. A real mother throws her heart over the fence and then climbs after it, thinks Cheryl. Also, I felt like a statue of something virtuous. Also, was I, like honey, thinking it's a small bear, not realizing the bear is just the shape of its bottle? We don't always know what intimate life consists of until novels tell us. Thus, three quarters of the way through, the first bad man takes a hard right turn and becomes a powerful mother-son love story. It is as if July became a mother herself during the writing of the novel. I believe she did. Mother love is everywhere, though it often feels like a very feverish pity. July's faux cinematic ending reaches into the future to give this tale of an abandoned infant, Klee's, and a lonely single foster mom, Cheryl, an ending that is all wish fulfillment. When one throws an ending happily into the future, one risks sentimentality, or at least overly neat conclusions. When one concludes by throwing happiness into the past, one can end with a moment of unrealized, elegiacally positioned hope, which is often less sentimental since such promise is seen whole and is usually partially doomed and more precise than the rapturous gauze of faux cinema. July risks the sentimentality, but somehow, because the ending reprises and builds upon a small piece of large hope placed earlier in the book, Cheryl's vision of her adult son, which becomes a premonition, it leaves one breathless. A reader may burst into tears whether it's warranted or not. The book's epilogue is moving, like an avalanche is moving, and one realizes only then that one has been waiting the whole time for this very thing. And so, one welcomes the multi-talented Miranda July to the land of novel writing. She is difficult to categorize. She is between generations. She believes in psychic connection, the spiritually purifying aspects of passion, the porousness of the self. Her lines sing. She can sing. She doesn't know that much about narrative structure. No one belongs here more than she. 2014. True Detective. The low-key romance that grows between two people working side by side has sometimes been the subject of great literature. It constitutes the most optimistic part of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina and the least gruesome part of Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd, which ends with an authorial lecture on camaraderie and how men and women are often denied it when confined to gender-specific work. Both novels make their arguments for fond, sensible bonding born of cooperative labor. Television understood this, somewhat, early on, and at least by the 1960s, producers began to fabricate work situations where male and female characters, well, maybe only one female character, could week after week banter and attach without having actually to date. The comedy writer's room in The Dick Van Dyke Show, the investigative reporters and their researchers in The Name of the Game, various West Coast detectives and their secretaries or assistants, Mannix, Ironside, the Mary Tyler Moore Show's Minneapolis television newsroom. No passion was truly in play in these job settings, but sibling-like intimacy and affection between the sexes was the glue that held the ensembles together week after week. Still, as glue goes, American screen narrative has mostly preferred the bromance, the cowboy aspect of two male detectives getting to know each other on a hot or cold case. Women detectives in the United Kingdom, Helen Mirren in Prime Suspect, Gillian Anderson in The Fall, have tended to go it alone. And if the brotherly duo also expresses our nation's federalist principles, as well as its difficult class divisions, by having one educated person at the state or national level team up with a local law enforcement officer who has never left town, well then, people, we have a show. The only gender reversal I've seen of this, The Heat, starring Melissa McCarthy as the local cop and Sandra Bullock as the FBI agent, was set in Boston and played for laughs, and was one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. When True Detective aired last year on HBO, it was squarely in the familiar trope of two guys getting to know each other on the job, doing some squabbling, some drinking, and having each other's back. At the end, there is a long, predictable rescue of one by the other. And yet, it seemed entirely original. This is due to several elements that are all in perfect sync with one another. The Louisiana setting, its shabby Gulf towns, its tent meetings of Bayou Baptists, its silvery swamps, the exquisite cinematography of Adam Arkapaw, and the acting, all threaded on the same needle by the director, Cary Joji Fukunaga. These worked together to give the show the look of a great film, where characters seem a natural part of the locale. Through sensitive photography, the setting seems to liquefy and flow into the cast, to form, not just inform. The character's blood and spit, vowels and squints, head shakes and struts. Their hot tears are a warm rain from the wide celluloid sky. This is assisted by first-rate actors who possess the highest powers of concentration. The ability on a camera-laden set to inhabit a character without a twitch of distraction or preoccupation or visible hint of the internally or externally irrelevant is a scary but brilliant feat. Ordinary people cannot do it. But I have seen great actors do it even at cocktail receptions full of cell phones. In a world where major writers have announced that they cannot focus on their work without extracting or blocking the modems in their laptops, this kind of thespian concentration is worth noting. One thinks of the writer Anne Lamott's remark on her own maturing undistractability. "I used to not be able to work if there were dishes in the sink," she has said. "Then I had a child, and now I can work if there is a corpse in the sink." Woody Harrelson as Louisiana cop Marty Hart, with his angry underbite, interesting blood pressure spikes, and recognizable male jazz moves, gives a performance that grows more impressive on subsequent viewings. While Matthew McConaughey as the former DEA agent Rust Cole with his extravagant enigmas and bored-to-the-gills gnomic utterances, is instantly mesmerizing. He believes the world is a giant gutter in outer space. When Hart, his CID partner of 3 months, asks him if he's a Christian, he says, "In philosophical terms, I'm what's called a pessimist." "What's that mean?" asks Hart. "It means I'm bad at parties." "Let me tell you," replies Hart, "you ain't great outside of parties either." Rust Cole feels the entire human species should do itself a favor and just walk off into the eternal sunset. He himself is intermittently on the wagon and doesn't have the temperament for suicide. He and Hart are a hoot and were made for the long police vehicle rides that Hart would like to turn into a silent zone and yet never does. "Why don't you just watch that car commercial if you like McConaughey's acting so much?" a true detective skeptic recently said to me. I love that car commercial, though I've now forgotten what car it is for. Harrelson's and McConaughey's performances are indelible and distinctive, if easily parodied. One can go to YouTube and find some amusing imitations. I recommend a video titled True Barista. But as with many parodies, they honor with their mockery. No writer was ever parodied more than Hemingway, and parodies do not necessarily disparage their sources, but rather sing cozy, observant ditties alongside them, as the Greek etymology of the word parody recommends. In any case, simultaneously embracing laughter and the object of that laughter is only irony and keeps you in intelligence, not assassination. Watching Harrelson and McConaughey together is pure joy. There is a bit of Hemingway in True Detective, the terse veil of tears dialogue, the visitor from far away filling up with the air of a new land. Hart and Cole, not pronounced soul, but we feel the blackened spirit, garden and enact their forensic partnership, sharing one woman, many cigarettes, and a mild fascination with each other, while remaining their own best advocates, a psychological project that seldom lets up. Hart clings to his hard-won normalcy, wife, kids, house, job, even if it bores him. Cole has left all that. He lost his only child and is now completely on his own in the world, having been raised by a Vietnam vet survivalist in Idaho to whom he no longer speaks. Cole's shootout with some biker drug runners is filmed and scored to resemble something from that war, so says the show's writer and creator, Nick Pizzolatto, so we are made to understand that the 1960s have forever hovered in a damaging way over the children who grew up in that decade. This idea continues in season two, when Rachel McAdams, as the daughter of a haughty spiritual leader, speaks derisively of having grown up on a hippie commune. Cole, the former DEA undercover agent, has been put on a murder case with Lake Charles cop Hart because the crime seems to be of a serial nature. A visitor from another world, which may only be Texas, where his previous work records have been redacted, Cole takes notes in a large ledger and speaks as if he were the CEO of a nihilist fortune cookie company. He is reprimanded on his existentialism by the partially spellbound Marty. "I wouldn't go around spouting that shit, I was you. People around here don't think that way." Despite the region's tent-top religiosity, Cole's oracular soliloquies will be deemed unhinged. In a gentler moment, Marty says to Cole, "For a guy who sees no point in existence, you sure fret about it an awful lot." Harrelson brings a nice comedic drawl to his line readings. His Marty Hart is trying to be a good family man, but remains an ordinary hothead and philanderer who has married up in society and is of several minds about it. As a result, he takes up a little torridly with a court stenographer, which gets him kicked out of the house, putting him in closer domestic proximity to his work partner, setting parts of the story in faster motion. The show's languidness, however, is part of its charm, part of its cable medium, and the imitative fallacy notwithstanding, part of its portrait of the South. Even to say that True Detective has a plot, that is, a story that proceeds as a set of human actions and their consequences, is to miss what there is to admire about the series' ambling and rich narrative. Not the story, which is alternately incoherent and trite. The narrative is really more an assemblage of characters and scenes. To summarize the plot would make it seem boring and absurd. In short, the detectives are trying to track down who or what is responsible for some ritualistic murders of women, either a cult or a lone sicko or both. They have to interrogate the local tough guys both in and out of jail, and there's a lot of vague talk about the Yellow King, a term used to give a screenwriter's loose idea a little mythic buttressing. Although the writing may be the weakest link in the show, it is helped in season one by T-Bone Burnett's music, which is steadily mindful of ambiance, mood, roots. The first season script has things to recommend it, primarily a useful time-straddling structure, in which convincingly older incarnations of Hart and Cole are under investigation by internal affairs and are allowed, in response to the interrogator's questions, to offer additional, if laconic, interpretations of each other throughout the 8 episodes. Pizzolatto also provides sharp, amusing dialogue custom-fitted to the actors, plus a deep understanding of Louisiana, where he grew up. A scene shot in a Lake Charles strip club, located directly across the street from a girls' dancing school, is something a fiction writer cannot make up persuasively, despite the facts, despite the serendipitous signage, so Pizzolatto doesn't include it, but mentions it in the commentary. He knows when reality is interesting, when reality is irrelevant, and when reality is no excuse. The sense of what to leave out comes from sifting through one's profound knowledge of a locale. Intelligently exploiting a terrain, largely unfamiliar to the viewer, works well here, and has been effective in other off-kilter police procedurals, from Joel and Ethan Coen's Fargo, which used the snow of the director's boyhood Minnesota to great advantage, to Top of the Lake, in which Jane Campion's native New Zealand is filmed with intimacy and awe by True Detective's own season one cinematographer, Arkapaw. Thus it is disappointing to see True Detective season two return to the belly of the beast of conventional cop dramas, Southern California. And a lot of what was sometimes disparaged about the first season of True Detective, its Southern Gothic noir, its amusing faux philosophy, its virility, will be missed in the much limper second season. A motif of impotence pervades all the bedrooms in season two. The setting is an L.A. suburb called Vinci, Latin for overcome, spent. Teeth and teeth-like objects spill out like the most Freudian of dreams. What the fuck is Vinci? One character asks. A city, supposedly, is the reply. We get the world we deserve, says the new season's poster. Alas, we don't even get the second seasons we deserve. Season two has a different crew, different cast, different directors, and most unfortunately, a different cinematographer. It doesn't resemble the first season much at all. T-Bone Burnett still does the score, but the music is heavy, unintegrated, full of dread. Leonard Cohen sounding gruff and demonic in the title sequence, a chanteuse in a nightclub called The Black Rose wailing, "This is my least favorite life," only 50 minutes in, a baleful jazz trumpet accompanying pensive aerial shots of nighttime highways. All do little but subtract by attempting to underscore. Burnett goes for something gloomier and synthetic here, the music working largely as interior monologue for the new characters, who now have an even lesser script to live in. The primary creative holdover from the first season is Pizzolatto, and so one may recognize the same random pacing, the non-converging storylines, the villains in scary masks, strangers wearing angel wings, the gingerly skirting of the subject of race, the non-stop interest in sex workers, a weary sympathy for the devil, the damaged perpetrating their own damage, and the abundance of flat female characters who are rounded out by scenes that have them scold their men and show agency, as is said in craft discussions. These new detectives of Season 2, Antigone, or Annie, Bezeridis, Rachel McAdams, rocking her family anger, Ray Velcoro, Colin Farrell, rolling his desperate family love, and Paul Woodrue, Taylor Kitsch, racing away from the Mideastern desert to Crete and a guy he once slept with, are all psychically burned to a crisp. The dialogue is hard-boiled and tight when not desperately working at exposition. "Can I ask how much you drink in an average week?" a concerned doctor noting Ray's redlining liver asks him. "All I can," Ray replies. As in the old TV show The Mod Squad, which these cops seem to be referencing in their beauty, their backstories, their leather jackets, their inscrutability, and recruit potential for undercover work, this is an impressive trio of California young people. Though it is sometimes hard to notice their appeal when they are so dissolute, disgusted, or just weary, and hidden from the sun in windowless interiors whose ochre lighting and general color scheme are something like Edward Hopper meets Dennis Hopper. At least one scene is a direct visual quote from Nighthawks. In the shadowy claustrophobic rooms, the crew's light sometimes hit an actor's face in the copperish air, a visual pun, and eyes glint and glisten, cat-like, often without motivation. When our true detectives first meet one another and form their accidental trio at the end of episode one, they have been summoned in the middle of the night. Two of them are drunk, and the other has just tried to commit suicide. All of them are staring at a rest stop picnic bench, on which sits the upright corpse of a missing city manager who has had his genitalia cut away and his eyes burned out. This is our welcome to True Detective Season 2. The funny sparks of life that lit things up between Hart and Cole will be hard, if not impossible, to find here. Bits of Chinatown, The Big Sleep, Twin Peaks, and other detective films will lumber in instead. Any humor will be in the hands of Vince Vaughn, as a struggling casino owner named Frank, and will probably be inadvertent. Vaughn, who like George Clooney radiates tidy, unsexy handsomeness, Vaughn's delicately featured profile is similar to Julianne Moore's, has difficulty melting into the fabric of this program, trouble blending with its look and tone, and so stands out as very much himself, as in, what the heck is Vince Vaughn doing in this show? He has his mouth full, spouting nonsense like, sometimes your worst self is your best self, or, it's like blue balls but in the heart, or, never do anything out of hunger, not even eating. As well as other lines that, as The Atlantic has pointed out, sometimes sound as if they've been Google translated from Farsi. Vaughn's rushed delivery resembles that of the character he played in the romantic comedy Wedding Crashers. This same-in-every-film movie star trait he also shares with George Clooney, though not with the utterly transformed Rachel McAdams, who was also in Wedding Crashers. In fact, party crashing may be the real metaphor of this season of True Detective. The McAdams character, Annie, does in fact crash a party, ostensibly for investigative purposes. She is there to rescue and be rescued, the meat of all cop dramas, as well as to recover an ugly childhood memory from Dad's dubious commune. Early on may be too soon to say that Vaughn is miscast, though one wonders how the show might have improved if Vaughn and Farrell each had the other's role. Vaughn's hypnotically askew performance grows on the viewer. Perhaps his performance will become legendary with time. The city of Vinci is already practically named for him. He plays Frank with inexpressive manipulativeness, a dapper low-level gangster who is also an outsider. His face has the stillness of a hitman's, but every once in a while fear darts across his empty eyes. Though the tallest in any room, Frank is in over his head. Again, a crasher, and at season's end, Vaughn begins to own the cartoonishness of his two-bit psychopath and bully, and his Proustian death trudge in the final episode could have been funny, but strangely, is what it's supposed to be, a ghost story. We see him as perhaps the rivetingly rotted peg that has held the house together from the start. After all, this is the land of show business, of visions in the desert. Still, one hears Vaughn's own tedium in lines like, "Osip, we talked this through in Paris. Casper's absence don't mean a thing." But when the Russian thugs with whom Frank is trying to do land deals speak better English than he does, it ends up eliciting some viewer pity, plus a smile, if a quick one. Frank lives, literally, in a glass house, and so we wait for the stones to come boomeranging. The incomprehensibility of this storyline, mine pollution, toxic dumping, the demise of the family farm, high-speed rail proposals, high-end hookers, spiritualists who size up auras like net worth, mysterious suicides, can only be alleviated by a dash of predictability. But instead of remaining in all that glass, he later carves up a treacherous henchman's face with some. Frank unexpectedly downsizes to a Glendale bungalow with wallpaper, and eventually to plane tickets to Venezuela. When the body count around him gets a little high, killing calms and tames him, as is said of hawks, he becomes a thrilling arsonist. Meanwhile, the mod squad, Annie, Ray, and Paul, is having its private adventures. With righteous indignation, Annie Antigone, sporting a non-stop fume and seethe, plus ombre hair that is cleverly used by season's end to indicate the passage of time, takes on her bogus guru of a dad, who, in his, or the writer's, sloppy neoclassicism, has named his other daughter Athena after the goddess of love. Really? Also, like her older counterparts in The Fall and Prime Suspect, as well as the French police procedural Spiral, Annie will have to endure reprimand and suspension for sexual misconduct with a subordinate. Women. In her required group therapy, where she is the only female participant and the scene struggles unsuccessfully toward a humorous moment or two, there is too much vacant glowering for things to lighten. There is no tension or shared secret that might produce the release of energy humor requires. Comedy has to have its finger on the pulse of irreverence, something season one understood. But season two is too full of its own earnest regard for Annie's contemptuousness, despite McAdams's often admirable performance. Audience anticipation cannot be comedically disrupted, because the entire movement of the story is desultory, without suspense, and the characters are too often defeated by it, despite a handful of well-directed set pieces. The shootout at the end of episode 4, Ray and Frank with their guns drawn under a breakfast table in episode 6, the entirety of episode 7, shot with close-ups and crane shots, and some real emotion. Ray, who, as he says, isn't good at being muscle, and yet Frank hires him as such twice, on very little evidence, a bad tip, has avenged a long-ago rape of his long-ago wife. In a gaping hole in the storyline, the possibility that Ray is not the biological father of his son is going to be used against him in a custody battle. A legal consultant might have informed the scriptwriter that regardless of biological parentage, California, like most states, makes the man who is married to the mother at the time of a child's birth the father of that child, and also provides for marriage by estoppel. Ray is his son's legal father, regardless of the child's flaming red hair. DNA tests are irrelevant in this custody contest. That this forensic error continues into judicial hearings and right on through the finale, as if it were suspense, is unfortunate. Getting ready for his day in court, or his interview with internal affairs, who knows for sure, Ray starts chewing gum and drinking water, and in general cleans up nicely. He casts an alert sidelong glance at Annie, a bit of foreshadowing. Watching the gifted Colin Farrell work hard, with complicated feeling and no Dublin accent whatever, in scenes that often add up to nothing, is unfortunately a little like watching his career itself. "I'm enjoying this soberish you," Frank tells him, "where your head doesn't dip and fall when I talk." All this while, Paul is resisting the claims that his sexual past and his days in Black Ops keep making on him. One of the plot's many improbabilities is that it suggests a gay affair would be grounds for blackmail, even when one is no longer in the military. It is satisfying to see Taylor Kitsch shake off his defining role as Friday Night Lights' Tim Riggins. Nonetheless, Kitsch may be the only one here who is better when speaking and moving than gazing off pensively, which the directors have him do too much of, even into mirrors, and often when he is simply fixing his expression, he sometimes seems lost as an actor, as if he doesn't know the camera's still rolling. Esquire, in a piece called What is Taylor Kitsch Doing with His Face?, had some fun with the actor's dazed gaze during a sex scene. Mid-season, at the end of an astonishing shootout filmed like a battle in Fallujah, an episode concludes with Ray and Annie stooped in anguish, but leaves Paul unbent, surrounded by carnage, and looking guiltily triumphant, if also unclear about what just happened. Paul is a god warrior, and perhaps confusion goes with being such a deity. One wants to shout cut before the camera does cut, though when the camera does, it freezes to an eloquently composed frame of dubious victory, pulled back to view a devastating scene, which makes one suddenly optimistic about the rest of this wild show's second season, as if it finally has gotten its legs beneath it. But things grow random again. The timeline lurches, the music becomes even stranger, often playing against what is on the screen. Incongruous 1940s orchestral strings accompany a drugged-out orgy, for example. Just as early on we see Ray's father watching Kirk Douglas in Detective Story, in the finale, a poster of Sam Peckinpah's Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia is shown long enough to let you know Pizzolatto's narrative aspirations, though a PowerPoint presentation might have been more clarifying. The Mod Squad, despite being taken off the streets after their huge shootout, are all working from their new posts in evidence, insurance fraud, and gangster consultation to get back out in the field again and to locate some missing persons, a script doctor, and to solve some not very interesting crimes. Misuse of a good cast. Along with cadmium and uranium, and more than a nickel or two, talent has been carelessly disposed of, devaluing some good ground. Mine runoff, party crashing, the recessive gene of the red hair of Satan, plus waste management, generally are the leitmotifs of True Detective's second season. Though not everything amounts to a hopeless wreck, when we lose Kitsch's Paul in a scene that is pretty much a steal from Martin Scorsese's The Departed, it has the same devastating effect as losing Leonardo DiCaprio. And when there is finally some eros in the room between the remaining two detectives, it too is emotionally convincing. They kiss like they mean it. Consequences ensue and haunt. Colin Farrell enacts the gypsy husband that memoirist Emma Forrest, your voice in my head, claimed him to be. He is the Heathcliff in the house, and despite the sentimental gestures toward the innocence of children and the strength of women, which the script nods at hurriedly as it rushes headlong to its close, his true detective proves Hardy right. Love of work is love indeed. 2015. Making a Murderer. Wisconsin is probably the most beautiful of the Midwestern farm states. It's often dramatic terrain, replete with unglaciated driftless areas, borders not just the Mississippi River, but two great inland seas, whose opposite shores are so far away they cannot be glimpsed standing at water's edge. The world across the waves looks distant to non-existent, and the oceanic lakes stretch and disappear into haze and sky, though one can take a ferry out of a town called Manitowoc, and in 4 hours get to Michigan. Amid this somewhat lonely serenity, there are the mythic shipwrecks, blizzards, tornadoes, vagaries of agricultural life, industrial boom and bust, and a burgeoning prison economy. All have contributed to a local temperament of cheerful stoicism. Nonetheless, a feeling of overlookedness and isolation can be said to persist in America's dairyland, and the idea that no one is watching can create a sense of invisibility that leads to the secrets and labors the unseen are prone to. Deviance and corruption, as well as utopian projects, untested idealism, daydreaming, provincial grandiosity, meekness, flight, far-fetched yard decor, and sexting. Al Capone famously hid out in Wisconsin, even as Robert La Follette's Progressive Party was getting underway. Arguably, Wisconsin can boast the three greatest American creative geniuses of the 20th century, Frank Lloyd Wright, Orson Welles, and Georgia O'Keeffe, though all three quickly left, first for Chicago, then for warmer climes. The State Tourism Board's campaign slogan, Escape to Wisconsin, has often been tampered with by bumper sticker vandals who eliminate the preposition. More recently, Wisconsin is starting to become known less for its ever-struggling left-wing politics or artistic figures, Thornton Wilder, Laura Ingalls Wilder, than for its ever-wilder murderers. The famous late 19th century Wisconsin Death Trip, by which madness and mayhem established the legend that the place was a frigid frontier where inexplicably gruesome things occurred, perhaps due to mind-wrecking weather, has in recent decades seemingly spawned a cast of killers that includes Ed Gein, the inspiration for Psycho, the serial murderer and cannibal Jeffrey Dahmer, and the two Waukesha girls who in 2014 stabbed a friend of theirs to honor their idol, the internet animation Slenderman. The new documentary, Making a Murderer, directed and written by Laura Ricciardi and Moira Demos, former film students from New York, is about the case of a Wisconsin man who served 18 years in prison for sexual assault, after which he was exonerated with DNA evidence. He then became a poster boy for the Innocence Project, had his picture taken with the governor, had a justice commission begun in his name, only to be booked again, this time for murder. Ricciardi and Demas's rendition of his story will not help rehabilitate Wisconsin's reputation for the weird, but it will make heroes of two impressive defense attorneys, as well as the filmmakers themselves. A long-form documentary in 10 parts aired on Netflix. The ambitious series looks at social class, community consensus and conformity, the limits of trials by jury, and the agonizing stupidities of a legal system descending on more or less undefended individuals, the poor. The film is immersive and verite. That is, it appears to unspool somewhat in real and spontaneous time, taking the viewer with the camera in unplanned fashion, discovering things as the filmmakers discover them. An illusion, of course, that editing did not muck up. It is riveting and dogged work. The film centers on the Avery family of Manitowoc County, home to the aforementioned ferry to Michigan. Even though the lake current has eroded some of the beach, causing the sand to migrate clockwise to the Michigan dunes, the eastern Wisconsin lakeshore has begun to fill forlornly with weeds. It is still a picturesque section of the state. The local denizens, whether lawyers or farmers, speak with the flat A's, throatily hooted O's, and incorrect past participles, had went, of the region. There is a bit of Norway and Canada in the accent, which is especially strong in Wisconsin's rural areas and only sometimes changes with education. The Avery family are the proprietors of Avery Auto Salvage, and their property, a junkyard, on the eponymous Avery Road, is vast and filled with over 1,000 wrecked automobiles. It is a business not unlike farming, in that in winter everything is buried in snow and unharvestable. The grandparents, two children, and some grandchildren live, or used to, on an abutting compound that consists of a small house, a trailer, a garage, a car crusher, a barn, a vegetable garden, and a fire pit. In 1985, Stephen Avery, the 23-year-old son of Dolores and Alan Avery, was arrested and convicted of a sexual assault he did not commit. There was no forensic technology for DNA testing in 1985, and he had the misfortune to look much like the actual rapist, blonde and young, and the traumatized victim, influenced by the county investigators, who had the whole Avery family on their radar, identified him in a lineup as her attacker. Despite having 16 alibi witnesses, he was found guilty. The actual rapist was allowed to roam free. After the Wisconsin Innocent Project took on his case, Avery was finally exonerated in 2003. DNA tests showed that he was not guilty and that the real attacker was now serving time for another rape. Avery then hired lawyers and sued Manitowoc County and the state of Wisconsin for wrongful imprisonment and for denying his 1995 appeal, a time during which DNA evidence might have set him free, which the state had mishandled, causing him to serve 8 more years. Days after Avery's release, Manitowoc law enforcement was feeling vulnerable about the 1995 appeal and writing memos redocumenting the case from 8 years earlier. The civil suit was making headway, and only the settlement amount remained to be determined. It was going to be large, and it would come out of Manitowoc County's own budget, since the insurance company had denied the county coverage on the claim. Then, in November 2005, just as crucial depositions were both scheduled and proceeding and Avery stood to receive his money, he was suddenly and sensationally arrested for the murder of a freelance photographer named Teresa Hallback, who had come to Avery's auto salvage on Halloween to photograph a truck for an auto magazine and whose SUV had been found on the Avery property, as eventually were her scattered and charred remains. Avery had 2 quasi-alibis, his fiancée, to whom he'd spoken at length on the phone the afternoon of Hallback's disappearance, and his 16-year-old nephew, Brendan Dassey, who had just come home from school. No one but Stephen Avery ever came under suspicion, and county investigators circled in strategically. After getting nowhere with the fiancé, they focused on the nephew, who was gentle, learning disabled, and in the 10th grade. They illegally interrogated him and suggested he was an accomplice. They took a defense witness and turned him into one for the prosecution. Brendan was then charged with the same crimes as Avery: kidnapping, homicide, mutilation of a corpse. Prodded and bewildered, Brendan had made up a gruesome story about stabbing Hallback and slitting her throat in Avery's trailer. The victim's blood and DNA were never found on the premises. A fictional scenario that came, he later said, from the James Patterson novel Kiss the Girls. When asked why he'd said the things he said, he told his mother it was how he always got through school, by guessing what adults wanted him to say, then saying it. In an especially heartbreaking moment during the videotaped interrogation included in the documentary, and after he has given his questioners the brutal murder tale they themselves have prompted and helped tell, Brendan asks them how much longer this is going to take, since he has a project due 6th hour. It is a crazy story, and the film's double-edged title pays tribute to its ambiguity. Either Stephen Avery was framed in a vendetta by Manitowoc County, or the years of angry prison time turned him into the killer he had not been before. But the title aside, the documentary is pretty unambiguous in its siding with Avery and his appealing defense team, Jerry Buting and Dean Strang, who are hired with his settlement money as well as money his parents put up from the family business. One cannot watch this film without thinking of the adage that law is to justice what medicine is to immortality. The path of each is a little crooked and always winds up wide of the mark. Moreover, nothing is as vain and self-regarding as the law. In Wisconsin, prisoners will not get their parole unless they sign formal admissions of guilt and regret. This kept Stephen Avery from his own release when he was younger. He clung to his innocence. These exacting corrections procedures are almost religious and certainly Orwellian in their desire to purge the last contrarian part from the human spirit. Any contempt for the law, even by a lawyer in court, will not go unpunished. And if one has the further temerity to use the law against itself, filing a lawsuit against law enforcement, for instance, one should be fearful, especially in Manitowoc, or so say many of the locals in front of Demas's camera. As portrayed in Making a Murderer, however, the law is not so vain that it doesn't point out the low IQs of the defendants. An IQ test, it could be asserted, largely measures the desire for a high IQ, while omitting the fact that in Wisconsin, most lawyers are practicing law without ever having taken a bar exam. If someone has attended law school in the state, the bar exam is not required to practice there, a peculiarity of Wisconsin. If the film does not do a good job in positing an alternative theory of the murder, surely it does not believe the sheriff's department killed Teresa Halbach? Or does it? This is because the filmmakers are busy following the charismatic Buting and Strang in their courtroom defense and pretrial investigation. These are men of the finest skepticism. In their skilled and righteous run at the state, they also seem the only ones in the film in possession of cool, deep, permanent mental health. And thus, these ordinary-looking men suddenly resemble movie stars. A Twitter love fest has sprung up around them, beginning soon after the documentary first aired, and their faces have been posted online accompanied by girlish hearts and declarations of love. But handsome is as handsome does, and Buting and Strang are not allowed to suggest that others might have committed the crime, due to a Wisconsin law involving third-party liability. And thus, everyone's hands are tied. The trial must proceed as one that is about police corruption and reasonable doubt. Nonetheless, we see any number of suspicious civilians with odd affects who may or may not have had the means, motive, and opportunity for murder. Halbach's killing is largely presented as a motiveless crime, though her brother, her ex-boyfriend, and a couple of Avery family members are seen on camera with odd expressions and bewildering utterances. Odd affect could be the film's subtitle and would certainly describe the demeanor of many of the court-appointed attorneys as well. Halbach's roommate did not report her missing for almost 4 days, her former boyfriend is never asked for an alibi, and can't remember precisely when he last saw her. Was it morning or afternoon? He can't recall. Nonetheless, he was put in charge of the search party that was combing the area near the Avery property in the days after she was finally reported missing. So who did this? Possibly Stephen Avery, but it looks like a crime that can never be properly solved. The story Avery's defense team tells of law enforcement planting evidence is completely convincing, and such conduct is hardly unprecedented in tales of true crime. The Averys were not allowed on their own property for 8 days while police roamed and rooted around, after which the scattered cremains, Avery's blood in the victim's car, and the victim's spare car key were all discovered. Blood taken from Avery in 1995 was also found to have been tampered with in police storage. But showing that there was police-planted evidence does not solve the crime. It only underscores its not proven status for purposes of a courtroom defense. And so the filmmaker's story, if it is a crime story, a human story, is missing parts. One may be struck by the complete absence of drugs and drug business in a neck of the woods where such activities often feature prominently. The victim's personal life is almost entirely missing, and so she seems a tragic cipher. And although she and her scarcely seen boyfriend are broken up, he still figures out how to hack into her cell phone account and attempts with anxious nonchalance to explain on camera and on the stand how he did so, though it seems to have been done with some extremely lucky guessing involving her sister's birth dates. Messages are found deleted. This seems more damning than the 3 calls Avery himself made to Halbach, returning a call from her the day she disappeared. The fact of Avery's calls to Halbach was left out of the film, though it was offered as evidence in the trial, as if the filmmakers themselves were unreasonably, narratively afraid of it. Early on, because of Avery's civil suit, Manitowoc investigators were ordered by the state to allow neighboring Calumet County to do the primary investigation into the murder. Conflict of interest, due to the wrongful imprisonment civil suit, was recognized from the start. But this order was not enforced, and Manitowoc sheriffs did not stay away, and the opportunities for evidence planting were myriad. The prosecutor and even the judges are seen to proceed with bias, professional self-interest, visible boredom, and lack of curiosity. At one point, the special prosecutor is seen in the courtroom staring off into the middle distance, playing with a rubber band. The story one does not see clearly here is really a story of small-town malevolence. The label white trash, not only dehumanizing but classist and racist, the term presumes trash is not ordinarily white, is never heard in this documentary. Perhaps the phrase is too southern in its origins, but it is everywhere implied. The Averys are referred to repeatedly by others in their community as those people and those kind of people. "You did not choose your parents," says an interrogator, trying to pry answers out of 16-year-old Brendan, though his parents are irrelevant to the examination and are not being criminally accused of anything. Yet the entire family is socially accused, outsiders, troublemakers, feisty, and a little dim. What one hears amid the chorus of accusers is the malice of the village. Village malice toward its own fringes has been dramatized powerfully in literary and film narrative, from Shirley Jackson's The Lottery to Arthur Miller's The Crucible to the Michael Haneke film The White Ribbon to Suzanne Collins's The Hunger Games. One saw it also in the Perugia of Amanda Knox's ordeal. Trimming the raggedy edges is how a village stays a village, how it remains itself. Contemporary shunning and cleansing may take new and different forms, but they always retain the same heartlessness, the unacknowledged violence, the vaguely genocidal thinking. An investigator ostensibly on Brendan's defense team speaks openly of his distaste for the Avery family tree and says, "Someone said to me, we need to end the gene pool here." The German word Mitläufer comes to mind. Going along to get along, in a manner that does not avoid misdeeds, one of the many banalities of evil. Certainly one feels that frightened herd mentality among Manitowoc law enforcement, as well as members of the jury, the majority of whom were initially reasonably doubtful, but who, swayed by a persuasive minority, soon unified to a unanimous vote of guilty. Even the jury in Brendan's trial did not question the nature of the defendant's several and contradictory confessions. Such was their prejudice against the boy. It may or may not be useful to recall that early German settlers of Wisconsin, escaping the 19th century military autocracy in Europe, once believed that the American Civil War would break up the Union, producing some independent states that could then come under German rule. These ordinary German citizens did not get their own state, of course, and in fact had to share it with Scandinavians, Poles, and even Bulgarian and Cornish miners, but certain stereotypical German Bürger traits, from rule-boundedness to tidiness to anti-Semitism, are sometimes said to have persisted in Wisconsin life. A shocking number of Nazi sympathizers once resided in Milwaukee. A reputation for niceness may obscure, rather than express, the Midwestern character. When watching two New Yorkers construct a film about the sketchy Wisconsin legal system, one may overreach for cultural memes. Cogent thesis-making is not this film's strong point or its mission, and so a viewer is likely to veer off independently. Thus, the internet and media are full of armchair sleuths and amateur psychologists in the growing discussion of the film. But conformity and silence on the job are elements in this tale, and they are timely subjects. Businesswoman and amateur social scientist Margaret Heffernan has recently been publicizing the results of her workplace survey of willful blindness. According to Heffernan, 85% of people know there is something wrong at work, but will not come forward to report or discuss it. When she consulted with Germans, they said, "Oh yes, this is the German disease." But when she consulted with the Swiss, she was told, This is a uniquely Swiss problem. In the United Kingdom, the British are really bad at this. And so on. Willful blindness is everywhere, though touched on only glancingly in the film. And so it comes as something of a surprise that what the documentary does linger over most single-mindedly, either deliberately or unconsciously, is the theme of mother love, perhaps not unrelated to willful blindness on the job. It is not just Brendan's mother, Barb, who is her son's impressively fierce defender. Barb is described by her son's lawyer as a bulldog, and clearly the lawyer is afraid of her. In her close protectiveness toward Brendan, she quickly understands that he is ill-served by the court-appointed defense. But the filmmaker's story is also of Stephen Avery's aging and devoted mother, Dolores, who packs up boxes of photocopied letters and transcripts and sends them everywhere, from 60 Minutes to 2020, hoping to get some journalists interested in her son's case. The effect of the media is a fraught one in this film. Local TV news influenced many of the jurors, and the prosecution often used the press to communicate in unethical ways. Making a Murderer has invited parallels to the podcast Serial, which has recently and intrusively played a role in getting a convicted murderer a new hearing, though the evidence in that case was more substantial and readable, a crime of passion by a jealous and broken-hearted boy. The Teresa Halbach case is much more mystifying. Meanwhile, short and lame and chewing on her lips, Dolores Avery visits her son in three different prisons in Wisconsin and one in Tennessee. She speaks to him on the phone regularly and optimistically. In her fruit-printed house dresses and floral shirts, she faces the camera and conducts calm tirades against the legal system that has taken her son away. The filmmakers give her more screen time than anyone would ordinarily expect, and she and her husband close the documentary with a sense of domestic resilience. Their son and grandson are in prison for murder. Their business has gone under. Yet they will continue, arm in arm, a vegetable garden of kohlrabis, a smile of faith and hope. The film is in the grip of its own sentimental awe, but there are worse things in the world. 2016. Helen Gurley Brown. Somewhere back in the day, Helen Gurley Brown said that after a certain age, the only thing a woman could rely on to improve her appearance were good posture and expensive jewelry. At least, that is my recollection, though I no longer recall the exact source or context. The gender specificity, the whiff of doom in the goal, the daft simplicity, the conciseness, the candor, and the plausibility caused it to stick in my head, although my most recent earrings were bought for $3 from a street vendor. Perhaps this is because everyone who already has their ears pierced and pricked for this kind of suggestion is tired and looking for quick, pithy advice, especially, it is assumed, women, around whom a many-tentacled advice industry was fashioned long ago, with its golden age perhaps corresponding to the golden age of magazine publishing, suburban housewifery, and leisure time, again, somewhere back in the day. That men, both gay and straight, were once a considerable audience for these women's magazines, unacknowledged in the official target demographics, is another topic entirely, though I will mention it here in passing. I also recall once getting in the slowest grocery store line, so I could flip through Brown's Cosmopolitan in order to discover what five things advertised on the cover, alongside its monthly near taxidermic décolleté, who can recall the faces perched above, were sure to drive men wild, but not finding them anywhere and having to put the magazine back. Well, Brown may have only been pretending to know five. Her husband did the cover headlines. And although she undoubtedly knew some number of viable things, in her first book, Brown advises dozens of rather dubious ones, from broccoli almondine to joining the wealthiest chapter of AA to letting your lacy slip show beneath your office desk. Unlike Madame Bovary, you don't chase the glittering life. You lay a trap for it, she wrote in Sex and the Single Girl. She believed in showing an interest in sports. I've